What's up, y'all? Educated Guest Podcast, episode 33. It's your boy Zarf, a.k.a. Caesar Does It on them Twitters.
Rodrigo Aaron Sebia, Mr. Underscore A-Y-Y-Y on them Twitters.
And we would like to introduce you to a brand new member of the Educated Podcast team.
My man, your man, Ed Nunez, sound engineer, editor, and all-around good dude.
That's right. Welcome to the team, and we hope to get out more episodes for the public. We love y'all. We want to give you more. Let's do it.
Ed's going to be an instrumental part in helping us make this shit sound crispy.
So today's episode features Roberto Rivera, Madison, Wisconsin, by way of Chicago, by way of Texas. Your man's was dope.
I'll tell you, man, going from dope dealer to hope dealer, creating his own major, getting his PhD, my man's not only a scholar, but he's also a practitioner.
The story's all there, and we can't wait to get into it. For me, the thing was that all of these districts are now doing equity work. They're doing culturally relevant pedagogy, but sometimes they just scratch the surface.
Most times they scratch the surface.
And we get into all of that in this podcast. You know how we start the podcast off? We always ask about the early years and how that led into the educator that you are. We hope you enjoy Roberto Rivera, y'all.
Peace. All right, man. So let's start off at the beginning, man.
Yeah, tell us about the early years, man. About, you know, you in school and your experience with education when you was a kid, right? Give us the stuff that isn't in the TED Talk.
Right. Man, it's interesting, brother, because I was reflecting on it and, I feel like really when it comes to doing the TED Talks and closing the South by Southwest, I had that moment right before I went out on stage and I was like, dude, Brené Brown is here. All these people are here. They're all, New York Times bestselling authors. They're all, professors at universities and have millions of people who've seen their TED Talks and stuff. And I don't have all that, but I feel like my story and my experience, it represents a vantage point and a perspective that needs to be shared. And that is, being someone who was told I was LD, learning deficient, I knew I had gifts and I had something to contribute, but I didn't really feel like, I knew how to bring that out. And so unfortunately, some of the older gang leaders and drug dealers in the neighborhood were like, yo, you good with people, man. How about you sell some of this stuff for us,
Yeah.
So I started selling weed when I was in middle school, like seventh grade, And by eighth grade, sewing up the whole middle school. And so for me, I saw that as the only legitimate opportunity, to exercise that entrepreneurship spirit. And, it was so deep, man, that LD label was even if I moved to a different school, my transcripts, they took a little while to catch up and they put me in regular classes. I'd say, I need to be in a slow class.
Damn.
You know what I'm saying?
You already had it
so
in there, huh?
It was deep, bro, to the point like I self-selected to be in the slowest class.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, my name is Roberto, named after Roberto Clemente. So I always played baseball. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So even though my grades weren't always great, they were always good enough to just be able to, play ball. And so for me, I never planned to go to college. I never planned to do any of that. As a matter of fact, I started getting different people in different middle schools and high schools to sell weed for me. You know what I'm saying? So using my superhero power for evil, I was rolling with Darkseid in them. I wasn't with the Justice League originally.
Right.
And so a big part of that switch for me was, having my grandfather, who was that consistent, male role model in my life. And he didn't treat me like a knucklehead or a criminal or thug. He treated me like the person I am now, back when I was a teenager. You know what I'm saying? And so true. I could never quite catch a glimpse of what he was seeing, but all I could see was pain. And so for me, you know, when he died, that was a pivotal moment in my life, because I was like, this might be the whole reason I give up, or this may be a reason I figure something out. I don't know.
Wow.
So I went to that funeral, man, just with like an open heart. Like, dude, I'm, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm open, you know? And it was at the funeral. I knew he was involved with the community and stuff. And I knew he had, you know, struggled a lot as a young person, but I got to hear his story of being the only one in his family, the only one in his whole pueblo that had a dream to get an education, you know what I'm saying? And people made fun of him. And even his family thought he was crazy. Oh, you want to leave the farm, you know? But he left the comfort of the farm to confront his destiny. And he went and he got some education. He got a better job. And he started sending money so his brothers and sisters could also have a crack at an education. And then after it was all done, man, I there was a receiving line. I got to meet all these strangers in this cathedral. And there was people from different, you know, church groups, different not-for-profits. I didn't know it, but my grandfather was a Big Brother in the Big Brothers and Big Sisters program.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He had given even just small partial scholarships, you know, to kids who were from his pueblo, who were like my age. So they would have a crack at education. I was like, dude.
He was doing the work. Doing the work.
My grandfather, he was doing all this work in secret, you know, and sometimes you might have a Jerry Springer moment when some of the secrets start to come up. It was the opposite of that, man.
And I realized, you are the founder.
I was like, dude. And it just was a reality check, because I realized he left a positive legacy. And I realized that if I were to die, my legacy would be, you know, I could stay up all night and drink and smoke every day and hustle and rob people. And I said, you know what? I want to honor my grandfather's legacy. And I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do that. But I started, you know, a hip hop line of clothing, and I started volunteering at a teen center, man.
Okay.
And doing hip hop based, you know, after school work was a reciprocally transformative piece. You know, both for the youth and also for me.
And for you.
And I started writing hip hop theatrical productions, you know, so honestly, I feel like Hamilton owes us a little bit of money, because we've been doing that for years.
So Roberto, would you say that your grandfather's passing and then your realization of what he actually did for the community was that turning point from you going from dope dealer to hope dealer?
The day before the funeral, I probably was smoking all day and hustling. Then the funeral happened. The day after, I stopped hustling.
No way.
And, you know, it just takes one good friend. You know, I tell this to my kids, like, yo, you got to know the difference between a friend and a frenemy, you know? And a friend will push you to be greater than you know how to be. And I only had one real friend at the end of the day. And he said, Berto, he said, you want to stop hustling drugs and all that? That's good. But he's like, you're a hustler. I said, what do you mean? It's like, it's in you. You just got to hustle something legit. And I was like, I need a legitimate hustle. And so I started looking around me, and I knew, you know, graffiti writers that were, you know, well-known all over the nation were my homies.
Okay.
I knew another cat who printed up shirts and, you know, I said, man, I'm going to start my own hip hop line of clothing and call it Good Life. And let's be about something. So I started sponsoring different hip hop artists. And then I went to a teen center one day, and, you know, it's like a scene out of a movie, man. I go in there.
Hey, so real quick, zoom in on that Google Maps first for a minute. We know you're in the Midwest, but where are we talking about exactly? Where are we talking?
Yeah, so this actually happened in a city called Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, word. Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I graduated from high school in Galveston, Texas, south of Houston, aka G-Town. Been knowing about, you know, Chopped and Screwed, DJ Screw for 20 years.
Rap-A-Lot Records, baby.
Rap-A-Lot.
All that, man. We've been doing all that. And so I came up from Texas, you know, with a quarter pound of weed under my seat. And, you know, trying to get out of a situation, but, you know, like they say, you can get people out of Egypt, but you can't always get the Egypt out of the people. You know what I'm saying? So I recreated everything that I was doing in Galveston back in Madison.
A little summer vacation by Ice Cube?
Yeah.
A little bit. Hey, so
it was that entrepreneurship piece. And I was like, yo, I get a pound for $1.99 from Mexico, and I could flip that for seven times more in the Midwest? Yeah, I know what I'm going to be
doing. I'm doing it. What's give us a little bit of the – how old exactly were you when your grandfather passed away?
Yeah, so I was 18.
Oh, wow.
When I moved up to Madison, Wisconsin. And then I'd say about – I was like 19, okay, maybe 20 when he passed.
Wow, okay.
And so
you're still figuring out who you are.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, at that point – I already felt like I was grown. Like, you couldn't tell me anything. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I was like, yo, man, I got it figured out.
Right. And so you make this – it's just a trip to me that, like, so you from there, and now you rocking this PhD from Madison, Wisconsin, yeah, in a major that you created.
Yeah.
So fill in the blanks a little bit there, man, because I think that to me, I always trip out in the fact that, like, my man's came in here and got his PhD. That's cool. But the fact that you were able to create your own major.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that, man.
Yeah. So, you know, I started volunteering at this teen center, and I felt, you know, like I was starting to get woke, so to speak, you know?
Mm, yeah.
And we started doing, like, these workshops and they evolved to concerts and festivals. And one day we're just kicking in. Someone's like, man, you know, everyone's doing their separate thing and we're doing a couple festivals, but it's separate. Like, what if we did a play? And then they start talking about football. And I was like, yo, what did you just say? Like, a play. What if we did a hip hop play? And I was like, bro, that is amazing. So I actually went to New York and I had a homie out there that I knew for a while. He moved back and I visited him and went to a few different boroughs. Long story short, I got inspired and I wrote a play. And, you know, I'm writing plays and we're writing grants and, oh, you know, shit. The program starts really popping. And the young folks are, you know, starting to open up for different hip hop artists. DJ Jazzy Jeff's rolling through. Our kids are opening up.
What?
Conferences, Congress people are there. Kids are speaking and performing. And it was a reciprocally transformative piece. And I realized, well, man, you know, what if I'm not learning deficient? If I'm writing plays and getting invited to do this stuff, what if I just learn different? So I went to community college and I was like, let me just give it a try, see what's up. And my orientation was, I wasn't trying to get a grade. I was like, what can I learn in this class that can better empower me to go serve these young folks in my community?
Okay.
That was my whole thing. I didn't care about anything else. So I'm, you know, I'm taking sociology classes and I'm doing research on hip hop. And then I write a whole play on that piece, right?
Yeah,
on the birth of the hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, subsequently I start getting all A's in all of my classes for the first time, you know, and I'm winning community awards and stuff. You know, I get an award from Bill Clinton when I was like 21. Right.
Wow.
And so I'm just coming out, you know, with this idea. I realized I had been schooled my whole life, you know, and taught that, you know, the greatest assessment of intelligence was solving problems on a test.
Mm.
But what I was experiencing was different. It was a true educational experience.
Yeah.
That let me know that you can learn in a way that can empower you, that can be meaningful to you and transformative to your community. And once I got in that lane that I could learn stuff to help me better serve, mm-hmm, I was rolling out all cylinders to the point where I was, you know, doing my own writing and healing, where I completely gave up smoking herb. Man, I used to smoke weed every day, but I experienced such deep healing in the work, and it was such a natural high that even to this day I don't smoke herb anymore. You know? Wow.
There's hope for you yet, Rodrigo.
Maybe
hope.
I can make it. Maybe I can make it. No, but that, you know, that writing piece is so therapeutic, man. It's a trip, huh? Because it gives you that space to get it out of your head and onto the paper.
And the fact that you're kind of constructing your own knowledge using hip-hop as your source,
yes.
I mean, isn't that like an integral piece to culturally relevant pedagogy? I mean, right? Like how kids construct knowledge using culture?
I mean, you know, I remember I wrote, I can't remember what play it was, one of the first ones probably, I wrote it. You know, it's like I'm hearing voices. I just write down what I'm hearing. The whole play's done. And when I pen the last sentence, I straight up bawled, man. I don't know how long. Yeah. I just cried. And what I realize now as a scholar and academic, you know, but what I experienced then was this experience of post-traumatic growth. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So having a father who was alcoholic and abusive and going to 13 different schools before high school and leaving in the middle of the night and me and my mom getting beat, you know, I had some post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the industry and these big businesses are like, yo, you wanna, you know, deal with that pain? You just get high, get drunk, go buy stuff, right? Mm. And now that I'm getting into the literature, I realize that post-traumatic growth, you know, is where the pain becomes propane.
It
starts to fuel us, right? And so it can be triggered. One of the ways that it's triggered globally in collectivist cultures is when, you know, people start to tell their stories in culturally relevant ways.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
And when we as a collective start to take action socially to change our social realities,
right,
it can trigger that post-traumatic growth. So I'm experiencing post-traumatic growth, telling these stories, telling my story, mm-hmm, and taking action in the community. And the more that I learned about hip hop, I realized that the culture was different than the industry, and that hip hop culture might be the best example in the history of the world of post-traumatic growth, young people being empowered and transforming their community. So for me, that became my vehicle, you know, to eventually I transferred to UW-Madison, and what hip hop taught me was, you know, if you want to do something and it's not created, you create it. You know what I mean?
You make it yourself.
You know what I'm saying? So to give a little bit of context, you know, I was at the center and I was volunteering. Eventually they said, you know what? We can't have you volunteering like this. I said, what? Y'all going to fire me? I'm just volunteering. They said, nah, we're writing grants, you know, for these plays, and you put in all these hours. We have to hire you.
Wow.
I said, wait a minute. You want to pay me to do something I've been doing for free? Yeah. I said, okay.
Didn't know what else to say. All right. Like, all right, cool.
Like, sign me up for that. How do we make that official?
Yeah.
And so, so I finished up at the community college. I started getting paid at this after school program. And then a billionaire, because we're situated right downtown, decided that he wanted to build an art center. So we were on the city block that he wanted to demolish everything on this block. And so using eminent domain and you know, coming in under the auspice of urban renewal, they were able to blight the building. And they were going to shut down one of the most popular programs nationally. By now, we've had newspaper, magazine articles about the program. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so to make matters worse, they gave a little bit of money to the administration as hush money so that we wouldn't protest. And so now I'm being paid, and now my boss is saying, look, we got $100,000. We don't have enough to get into a new building yet. So we're going to do a capital campaign for the next year. So what about, you know, the 50 plus kids who are diehard coming here every day? Well, we're just going to have to pause programming for a year.
Mm. Nah, fam.
I was like, what? Oh, no, we can't do this. So we brought it to the youth and we said, look, here's the situation. We're just being honest. We're about to get kicked out of this building. We're told the program can't continue. And the kids are like, oh man, we got to protest. We got to rally. And like, yeah, I mean, we could, we'll all lose our jobs, but you know,
hey, you're like, hey, I just got this job, fam.
You know, I just got the job now. Shit. You know, the situation was that the youth, you know, after sifting through all the information and the emotions, they're like, well, yo, we've done already 3-4 plays. Let's do a play about our situation. Mm. About how this center has brought Black, Asian, Latinos, and Caucasian. We had an eclectic group, and how this has been a place for us to be empowered and healed. And so it was a brilliant idea. So we wrote this play called Fulfill the Dream.
Okay.
And it told the whole story about, you know, the community center, the youth, this dude trying to come shut it down, you know, the whole piece.
The whole thing.
And long story short, man, that play got us a ton of support. We raised over $700,000. We got it matched.
Oh, wow.
So we were able to build a multi-million dollar teen center in the city. And so when that wrapped up, I had graduated from community college. Okay. So I'm coming into UW-Madison, man, like
feeling yourself a little bit
and like Haley's Comet up in there.
Feeling yourself a little bit. All right.
You know? And so I come in there and I'm a junior coming in from community college, and they're saying, okay, you have to decide what your major is. And I said, man, I got to do theater. I got to do community development. I have to do African-American studies, Latino study. It was like 10 things I wanted to major.
Yeah. Okay.
And they said, okay, well, get ready for like 20 years of undergrad. So I'm flipping through the course book, and there's, you know, English and economics and, you know, the next one. And you know, and I see a little tiny paragraph in this thick book, little tiny paragraph. It says individualized major. I said, that's it.
That's my door.
That's the one.
I book it. And in UW-Madison, the administration is literally on this big old hill, man. So I'm going up the hill. I think I get to the top and I'm hot and sweaty. And I burst into my school counselor's office, Ben Rodriguez, who's a Latino brother. And I said, Ben, I figured it out. I'm not going to be in school for the next 20 years. I'm going to do this individual major. And he looked at me like this. Big sigh. He said, I can count on one hand. I've been with this university for 25 years. I can count on one hand the number of people who've been successful in doing what you're talking about. He was missing a couple fingers, by the way. So he was making a point. He's like, why don't you just pick one major? Why don't you go do dance or something? I said, Ben, dance ain't even on my list of my 10 majors. And so I left, man. I felt defeated, deflated. And this was right at the end of spring, so we were transitioning to summer. So I took a little time to do, I guess, what some would call a vision quest.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. Talk to the mountain. Out, you got to go to the mountain. Talk to the mountain.
I went to the wilderness.
Take some peyote.
And I didn't take any peyote, but, you know, I had to disconnect. And I came across a quote, you know, I brought different literature and stuff. It says, two roads diverge in the wood.
There you go.
And I took the path. Less
Robert Frost.
Yeah.
And that has made all the difference. As soon as I, you know, read that, felt in my heart, Creator is talking to me. He's like, dude, what path are you going to take? You know? And so I came back, went over to Ben Rodriguez's door. I said, Ben, I said, I'm going to do this individual major with or without your help.
Amen.
And he must have saw the determination in my eyes, because he was like, all right, man, here's what you need to do. Find a major at another university similar to what you want to do. Look at the breadth, the depth requirements that are part of that major. See if there's something similar here. You need to have a tenured faculty professor be your advisor. You need to draft up a proposal. You're going to have to submit an application and then defend your proposal in front of an interdisciplinary board of people from, you know, deans and different professors from these different colleges. He gave me the information. I was gone.
Love
in
it.
The library, bro. Looking up
Hit
stuff.
It. Hit
right
it.
Away. I ain't, you know, messing around. And I found something similar at Emory University, at Harvard, and at San Francisco State.
There you go.
Nice.
And so I pulled it together. I had a professor who was an advisor. He agreed to be my support. And so I went in to defend the proposal. And it's probably about 15 deans and folks from different departments all in one room.
Not smiling.
all salty.
And they didn't get the memo that I'm not defending a PhD dissertation.
Oh.
They went right in that mode. And so they took my proposal, bro. Shit. They tore that thing up. The only time I ever felt energy like this is when I was in an MC battle because I used to MC battle.
Yeah.
And people are trying to publicly humiliate you so you'll never want to rap ever again.
That
was the energy.
Damn.
Son. And so when I felt that, I was like, wait a minute. They trying to battle me. I'm like, okay, we about to get it in. So I had brought in my portfolio. So all the newspaper clippings and the magazine clippings, because they're like, this just seems ridiculous. Why do you even want to do? Where is this coming from? I said, well, I've been doing this for years. We've been doing this work. Here's my portfolio. Here's my award from Bill Clinton. They're like, oh, okay. Well, we just don't think that this could really hold any academic water. I said, here's a list of all the professors. You know all those courses? I went and met with each professor that teaches these courses here at this university. And here's the list of folks who signed off and support me. Well, we just don't think this is intellectually rigorous enough. And you know, when you're in a situation, you know that it is not going to go down. You know what I'm saying? You're like, wait a minute. They already made up their mind before I showed up.
Yeah.
And so a scene snapped into my head. And I remember once I saw a battle. And so there was this guy who was the reigning champion of, you know, this MC battle for 20 weeks. He was undefeated, big dude, dreadlocks. Like, he just was the master of that space. And then this little dude showed up, little skinny dude with a hat, you know, and he's doing pretty good. Young guy. And he gets up, you know, to the big boss, kind of like Super Mario Brothers. This is like Dozer or something, right? So he's ready to battle Dozer. And they flip. He's got to go first. He does pretty good. He's all right. And he goes to pass the mic, and instead he drops it. And he walks off stage like he already won.
Damn.
And to do that to this dude who was like 20-week reigning champion,
I
went crazy. Oh, go up. And it was just enough that it threw the reigning champion off, so he didn't perform that well, and the little dude won. Stole his crown.
So there you are in front of these tenured faculty members.
I'm like, okay, I gotta do something unexpected. So I start packing up my bag, and they say, Mr. Rivera, what are you doing? I stand up and I say, you know what, I can see this is not going anywhere. And I'm not going to waste any of your time anymore. And I'm certainly not going to waste my time anymore. I thought UW-Madison wanted to be on the cutting edge of education, but clearly that's not the case. I have good enough grades that I could probably get into Harvard. I was talking shit. I probably couldn't get into Harvard. I could go to Emory. They already have this. They're on the cutting edge, not you. And so I was getting ready to walk out the door. And they said, oh, Mr. Rivera, the meeting is not adjourned. Why don't we take a little break here and you step out for a moment, just take a breather. I stepped out, I'm in the hallway, and I'm thinking, dude,
heated.
I'm like, they're probably about to kick me out. I don't know anyone at Harvard. So I come back in, and I could tell that the facial demeanors of some of the people who had spoken had kind of changed a little bit.
Okay.
Softened up a little bit.
Yeah. Like they maybe said something, you know? And finally, the guy who was chairing the meeting, he said, well, you know, after further conversation, we don't think your major is that bad of an idea after all.
Piece of shit.
They couldn't even give you halfway. They only met you like a quarter of the way. It might hold a little water.
And so he said, but, you know, we are concerned about the intellectual rigor. So he's like, we will accept your major on one condition. I said, okay. He said, so a lot of your courses in your proposal are the beginner courses. And at the university, we have intermediate and advanced courses. He's like, we will give you permission to do the major, but you have to take the advanced level of the course. So in other words, you don't need to take the prereq. You have to take the advanced course of that particular topic.
Okay.
So what does that mean? Well, it means that most of your classes will be with people getting their master's degrees and PhDs. And so right there, man, I heard the tape in my head, and it was that teacher, you know, when I was in elementary school, saying, we're not going to have Roberto read. He's just slow. And I was thinking, dude, I'm too dumb for this. You know, legit. Like, this is what I really felt in my heart. But fortunately, I also heard in that split second the voice of my grandfather, And he had told me before, he's like, you know, don't give up on education, you know? And also the voices of the youth saying, big bro, it's your opportunity, do it. So I said, look, if this is the only way you'll give me a chance to do this major, I'll do it under these conditions. And so I had a, man, I did programs where I brought kids from middle schools to the university, independent studies. My senior thesis was a documentary film called Bridge the Gap, talking about the achievement gap, the racial disparity of incarceration gap, and how hip hop industry broadens the gap, and how the culture can help close the gap. Ooh. And I interviewed Chuck D and Talib Kweli and Davey D and a bunch of different heads.
My man.
And so that ended up being my senior thesis. And I ended up graduating with this major that I entitled Social Change, Youth Culture, and the Arts.
So, my man.
Funky fresh.
1 year later, check this out. This is real life.
Yo.
I get a call from the university. And they said, you know, we think your major is actually a pretty good idea. I'm like, okay, now you're going to. And so they said, you know, we have some ideas of doing a learning community around some of these topics that you included in your major. You know, doing spoken word and hip hop and engaging folks to do work in the community. Could we hire you as a consultant?
In the words of Biz Markie, they caught the vapors, man.
That's what I'm saying. So then I got hired to do consulting. And now UW-Madison is the only university in the nation that I know of that has a hip hop and spoken word learning community. Young people come from all over the world. They get a free 4-year academic scholarship to study whatever they want. They take some courses together to build their art and courses to help them better serve the community. Mm. And it's going in its like 10th year right now.
No shit.
First wave.
My man. Damn. My man.
Yo, so I think we need a break right now. My man Ed, would you please cue up something funky for us so that we can segue into this?
Something booganose funky.
I think that's good. I like that. Rodrigo, how you feeling so far about the episode?
You know, I really appreciate like the authenticity that Roberto has, dude. You can tell there's a big difference between the academics and the practitioners. Somehow he seems to blend both those two together.
You know what? His whole life experience has been just this struggle and then this crescendo, and this the light opens up and it shows him where he needs to be. It's an amazing story.
Absolutely, man. I love it.
Yo, check it out, y'all. So our next episode, we're going to delve into something different. We're going to get into that political realm. We interview Nathan Fletcher, candidate for District 4, San Diego County Board of Supervisors. That's like a whole different thing for us, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A little different. But you know what? You did a good job doing the interview, C's. I was not able to be there, but you did a great job, man.
You know, we touch on education, of course. We touch on cannabis. We touch on growth, smart growth, and gentrification in the city and homelessness. We touch on a lot of things, man.
Love it.
All right, y'all. So we're going to get back into the episode with Roberto Rivera, episode 33 of the Educated Guest Podcast. Let's go.
Thanks, Ed. Take us out. It was a trip, bro. It's like, I have a new role. I'm working over at the Heights of Kai Graduate School of Education now. So,
That's dope.
We got hooked up with some Gates money to do college access work, right? And so we're specifically targeting a small, like using continuous improvement, right? We're looking at 10 high schools in this first cohort. And we're basically just trying to support Black, Latino, and under and low-income students get into and through college, right? But one of the things I was writing about just today was about this idea of the imposter syndrome and how important the sense of belonging when we step onto a campus. And like a lot of people don't understand. People, students of color go into onto a university. That's the first time that you really recognize, like, yo, there's not a lot of people who look like me here. And that feeds this like narrative that you just shared, man. Like, I'm not smart enough. I'm not supposed to be here. What do you think either schools, school districts or universities can do to help, like, really kind of quell that sense of belonging, or that how do we get rid of that imposter syndrome from the institution standpoint? Because I know, like, we can do mentoring, but that's so one-to-one that it becomes challenging to do it at scale. Mm-hmm. So what do you think? What are some ideas that you might have for that?
Or is that just part of the educational experience? I mean, you kind of have to go through that personal struggle in order to come out a better student.
I don't know.
I'm reaching.
What do you think?
Nah, that's a great question, man. You know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, there's different manifestations of racism. You know what I'm saying? Mm. So racism is something that is institutionalized, and we can see this across the board. You know, we have a overrepresentation of Black and Brown students in special education, and an underrepresentation of us in, you know, honors classes and AP classes and that sort of thing. Study came out of New York saying that Black and Latinos are 6 times more likely to be mislabeled as special education than white students, you know. I went through a formal assessment that got me the label of being LD. And, you know, after doing their so-called, you know, research on me, they're like, yep, this guy, he's learning deficient. You know, his language acquisition is delayed. No one thought to ask, you know, is there another language being spoken in the house?
Shit.
And at that point, my tío, my tía came from Nicaragua. They didn't only... word they knew in English was no, it's because it's the same word in Spanish. So, you know, things are cooked into systems and institutions, you know, to specifically have Black and Brown youth, you know, not get the support and the academic rigor that's required to give them that educational experience. Mm-hmm. So one, two, you know, we have to remember that racism also manifests in interpersonal forms of bigotry. You know what I'm saying? You know, people coming in, oh, you spit, whatever, you know, you taco, all this stupid stuff. And then the third piece, racism manifests itself, is on that internal level.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of gets to that, you know, idea of the imposter syndrome, is that I went to a different school. And my transcripts back then, email wasn't as proficient, you know, kind of giving my age out a little bit. And so my transcripts hadn't come to the new school yet, but I had already internalized this label that made me say, nah, I'm going to advocate for myself to go in the slower classes.
Yeah. You know? Self-selecting, right? As you said earlier.
So I think really three things, you know, need to be done. I think one is it's important for institutions to really strongly try to make sure that the administration and the teachers are reflective of the students that they're trying to reach. You know, being able to see someone that looks like you, or even someone who doesn't look exactly like you. For me, I knew I could be a scholar the day I met David Stovall. You know, brother came to UW-Madison to lecture. He had a Nas t-shirt on and he had some jeans and some Adidas dreadlocks and a rubber band. He's like, yo, check it out. And he just went for 2 hours dropping the most scholarship I ever heard in my life and was hip hop 110% of the time. Right.
Man.
And I was like, whoa, you can be an academic and be authentically hip hop and yourself. I'm like, oh, man. So I think on an institutional level, we can do that. For the folks who are white, they need to be trained and becoming multiculturally competent. Mm. They need to do a little personal work to understand where they're from. And, you know, if we ever want to get to equity, man, we have to build empathy, right?
Empathy
can never be established without proximity.
Ooh.
So we need to help these folks understand their stories and understand the stories of the youth, their parents, and what's going on in the community. To build that proximity is so important to what you said earlier, Cesar, you know, and being culturally relevant. We need to become students of our students. And that requires being close, being proximate, right?
Yeah.
And then the third piece, you know, I think with the imposter syndrome is helping them to realize, like, yo, man, racism is real. You know what I'm saying? And some of the genius that's within you is something that we have to safeguard and we have to nurture. I love the quote from Buckminster Fuller. He says, all children are born geniuses. However, 9,999 out of every 10,000 are swiftly and inadvertently de-geniusized by grown-ups.
My man. Bucky's a trip.
I know, he's a trip. Evil scientist, crazy scientist.
Yeah, futurist Bucky. Yeah, Mr. Fuller.
But, you know, when I interviewed DMC, man, one thing that he said, you know, from Run DMC, he said, you know, hip-hop, you know, created multiple lanes for people to have careers. You know what I'm saying? It's not only a billion-dollar industry, but now you can be a hip-hop architect. You can be a hip-hop science teacher. You can be a hip-hop ED of an organization that incorporates that, right? And so, you know, imposter syndrome starts to dissipate when we start to feel like we are affirmed in our racial, ethnic, and cultural identities, and that what we're on and what we come from has got so much brilliance and ingenuity that when shared with that space can make it more efficient, more effective, mm-hmm. and a healthier ecosystem where we can all grow and we can all come up. Because that's hip hop at the core.
Yeah.
It's not just how do I make a come up, but how do we make a come up? How do we transform ourselves and our environment? And so when hip hop comes into the space, it transforms the space. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It goes from whatever hierarchical structuring is going on into a democratic playing field. And so even though now hip hop is in academia, the thing is, you know, we need to make sure that we don't just fit into the model of what is classified as bona fide knowledge and research. Hip hop being in academia means that the walls of the university become the walls of the community, and the community becomes part of the university.
You grazed over something that I was reading in a piece last night, and that is hip hop as a standalone or culturally relevant pedagogy as a set of tools is not deep enough and is going to fail. You touched on the piece that the institution, the people in the institution, need to look at how racism is systemically ingrained in that institution before they can utilize those tools or hip hop. Because as a standalone, it ain't going to get the job done.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I think a couple of things. You know, one, you know, Gloria Latsing Billings.
That's the piece I was reading.
Madison. Yeah.
Auntie Gloria.
Yeah, no. Auntie Gloria, man. She's an OG, you know, what I call education gangster.
Mm.
And so, you know, but her original research, you know, before she even, you know, interviewed and did the research on the teachers who were doing it well, she tried to figure out, okay, who are the teachers that are teaching these African-American kids well? And she consulted with the church.
Mm.
She consulted with people in the community, parents.
There you go.
And she triangulated the data and she was like, okay, these teachers have come up in multiple conversations. And then she went about, you know, observing and interviewing these teachers. But we skim over the piece. These were teachers that were known by the community. And I think we're so quick to want to come in with these PDs. Oh, yeah, we're going to be culturally relevant.
Yeah.
And we're going to help all these, you know, 90% of teachers are white women and they're going to be culturally relevant. But if honestly, if you don't have a relationship with someone that doesn't look like you, you know, how is that authentic that you're going to be this culturally relevant teacher, but you don't have any relationship with any black or brown folks in your everyday life?
Yep.
It ain't going to work.
Yep.
And so, so really what I'm trying to push, and it's unpopular, but I think it's needed, is just pushing educators on a personal level to become multiculturally competent, to get out of their little boxes and to build relationships and to become these students of their students and their families and their communities. And it will have this reciprocally transformative effect.
One of the principals that we have out in this district during their staff days this year was dope, because I had not seen one of our principals in this district do it. Basically took the half day and they did like a tour of the community.
Mm.
And like, so here are some hot spots in the community. This is where all the kids go. This is the teen center. This is this. This is that. This is this. Mm. Because a lot of the teachers come in and they just drop into the school and then they just know the four walls at which they work in. And then that's it. Maybe the lunch
lunch area, right? Mm-hmm. But outside of that, like, there's no context for them to build any of this information on, right? There's nothing for you to say, hey, man, you know, like, at the fruteria, you're over there, you know, with your tías. Right. That's cool, man. That's dope. But, you know, you could do this, blah, 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 blah. Like, there's no context to build stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you just in a vacuum of trying to just throw these content structures at students, and then they're like, what? What the fuck are you talking about? Like, I don't know you. I don't trust you. Right? Mm-hmm. So what have you seen? What are some common things in your work? What are some common themes that pop up where, like, people think they're doing it right, but they're actually doing it wrong? Like, so, like, teachers who come in, or school districts, or administrators, they're like, yeah, we're doing this. We're doing equity work. We're doing SEL, right? And then when you take a look deeper, they just it's a facade. What are some common things that you see with that?
I mean, it's a good question, man. Funny thing is, you know, I just was on a call before we did this interview with some folks. You know, I'll probably not tell you the name, but it's a big.
Don't out him.
He was about to.
Yeah. Don't out him.
It's a big publisher, man. They're real big. And doing publications in education, and they're trying to, you know, hop on this equity bandwagon and so forth. And so they hosted a half day training, and it was consisted of two keynotes, and I happened to be one of the keynotes. So I did my thing, man, and I went first, and then they had this other guy go up, and he's coming from Boise, Idaho. I should have known someone coming from Boise, Idaho, some white dude. Now, I went to Boise, man. There's a lot of Latinos in Boise.
Yeah.
What are they doing there?
I wonder if he knows about the Latino Leadership Summit over there. It's popping, you know?
Yeah.
And so he gets up there, and he goes for 90 minutes. He doesn't say equity once. Race doesn't come up once. Mm. Culture doesn't come up once. Relevance doesn't come up once. He goes into this whole piece that basically reinforces, like, tracking students and how to better track them.
We're going to track them, but in a good way.
Full of deficit language. You know, talking about, okay, yeah, then we can train teachers to, you know, help these kids that are delayed because of, you know, they're not getting what they need in the community, and they're not getting what they need through their families. And the
Superman
know,
syndrome.
Straight up savior complex.
Superman.
Savior complex,
oh,
son.
Oh, my God. I was like.
What about giving them the tools?
What hurts so much is this was marketed to everybody. This was in St. Louis, man. This was marketed to all these superintendents, all these people, you know, directors of equity as an equity and education summit. And it was just
it was
horrible,
the complete
man.
Opposite of what of the work we need to be doing.
And I told him on the phone, I said, look, I don't care how much you pay me. I will never present with that person ever again. You know, it makes me look bad. I'm thinking y'all have this figured out. And so I think it's real, and what I've seen in Chicago and other places, man, is it's real hype to talk about equity and social justice and cultural relevance, to have the verbiage of liberation, but the practice of oppression, it makes it 10 times worse. Ooh. You know, so we came in one of the most, you know, disengaged high schools in Chicago, Roberto Clemente High School in Humboldt Park. It's the Puerto Rican neighborhood. And they have a, you know, a group of students that are deemed chronically disengaged. And we said, look, you know, y'all want us to work with them. We're not, this is not an prevention. This is not an intervention. Yeah. This is invention. You know, we legit have some ideas around teaching social entrepreneurship to youth. And we want to test this out with the young people and see if we can get some businesses going. Oh, this sounds great. And we're like, okay, we'll do an all school assembly and let everybody know what this program is about. Dude, we start cranking, man. These young folks, you know, they wanted to do a clothing line called Dream Chasers. Man. Started doing logos. We printed one shirt and they went out. This is their own idea. They one shirt. They like, hey, here's a shirt. And they, you know, like we're selling chocolates. They pre-sold $1,000 of clothing in one day.
No
And brought
way.
Us all the cash. One day. stack of cash was like that. Oh, we went ahead and just, you know, pre-sold some shirts. We need to get on this. And so, you know, we got the shirts and started hustling them. And, you know, all the while teaching, you know, social emotional learning, critical consciousness in the context of them, you know, doing this business. There is a social enterprise.
Yeah.
And so we said, well, you know, how do you want to make this something that could benefit the community? Oh man, we should, you know, make 30% of our profits, you know, goes to the school because the school is lacking money. They said, but here's the thing. We want to dictate how that money gets used, you know? And so check this out. These young people in Clemente, we connect them to an athletic apparel. I'm not wearing the shirt now, but a company out of Atlanta called, what's it called? Old Boy Sports or something like that. Mm. So it's an athletic apparel company out of Atlanta. And they end up feeling moved listening to the stories of these young men. It's all black and brown young men.
Yeah.
And they say, you know what? We got a warehouse with 15,000 units. We will front all of these units to you. You print your logo on it and then just pay us the cost on the back end. Dude, 15,000 units.
What?
They're selling the t-shirts for $20 each. And they sold $1,000 worth of shirts in one day.
Wow.
So we're talking about the opportunity for them to make 300K.
Yeah.
Now, is there and so this on top of building partnerships, and this is when Joaquin Noah was with the Bulls. We're going to do a whole event with the police. And dude, it was – do you know what happened, brother?
What happened?
Mm.
The principal and the administration of the school, even though they knew – that they were going to get maybe $100,000 of this money that the youth wanted to dictate, they pulled the plug on everything. Red tape started coming up. We need reports about this. Oh, y'all didn't sign out the room. Oh, wait, there wasn't an adult, you know, blah, blah. Making all excuses to the point where the guy that I had put as the director of it,
uh-huh.
Like, they're like, we don't want him coming into the school.
What?
Like, making stuff up, bro. And they shut the program down. And what that taught me is just because someone has the language of liberation doesn't mean that they have the practice of liberation. That was the practice of oppression, you know? And so one thing I've learned to ask is, you know, ask a lot of questions, but also like, okay, how are you already promoting equity and social justice and diversity? You know, how are you holding yourself accountable? And the big one, man, is, you know, really seeing like, are you guys really serious about youth voice? And I'm not just talking about the affluent kids will tell you what you want to hear.
What you want to hear, yeah.
Because I believe, and I'm a living example of this, the at-risk, so-called at-risk youth, the chronically disengaged youth, when we can get healed a little bit, we can have the insight that can heal that system more quickly than anyone else. These young people, they had the most swag. They were the leaders of the whole school. They were the best rappers and dancers doing footwork in the whole school. They loved them. And when they started to get on board, it was like a tipping point for the rest of the school.
Mm.
And that threatened the power structure, man.
Yeah. And that's a trip, dude. It's a trip when you – because that's the insight that I just got from you sharing that was that these kids who have experienced trauma and even these adults who have experienced trauma – they are a looking glass into how we can support those students. Because when we take a look and we start to listen and we start to really, really listen about what's going on with students and we really sit and we figure out, oh, the root cause of you not showing up is because you don't have a house to stay at and you're traveling.
Yeah, man.
Now you have a different conversation with the kid. You have a different conversation with moms or pops or whoever, right? And the adults in the situation. Now we can figure out how we can serve these students. And so until we start listening to folks, we still playing darts blindfolded in the dark. You know what I mean?
You're telling the truth, man. Absolutely.
And so that's a trip, dude. I had not, like, it's funny that I had not, we intuitively know these things.
Yeah.
But when we hear the stories like that, man, it's like, that's it. It's the inception point that you, okay, yeah. We got the ahas.
Because for these, some of these youth to be liberated and empowered, it means that the whole space is going to change.
Yeah. Yeah.
It means that the whole power structure is going to start to level out a little bit.
Right.
It means that we're actually going to create an ecosystem where everyone can thrive. And most of these systems and institutions are not set up that way, man.
Yeah.
You know, brother Jeff Andre de Duncan says it best. He's like, the outcomes that we're getting are perfect. He's like, they're perfect. This is the perfect outcome that you get for this system that's designed this way.
Yeah.
You know, this is exactly what you're going to get. These disparities, when you have a system like that. So if we want to change the outcome, we got to start restructuring this whole thing. And honestly, I'm going to be real honest. I don't think most folks in public education are ready for that, man.
Oh, no.
And the sad thing is, we know that 65% of elementary school students will end up in a job that doesn't exist yet.
Right.
50% of high school students will end up in a job that doesn't exist yet.
Mm-hmm.
Top 10 jobs last year didn't exist 6 years ago. And what we're talking about is the type of work that we're doing, social entrepreneurship, you know, arts-based, you know, creative youth development, all this kind of stuff that's been happening in out of school is better preparing the students to get these jobs, to create these jobs. And so out of school time folks and youth development folks,
talk to me.
There's a charge on us. And that is we gotta bring some of these tactics and these ideas, this holistic kind of strength-based, culturally relevant approach, and start infiltrating the schools, man. You know, how is it that a young person is going to be a genius, you know, between 4:30 and 8:30 and be
a knucklehead,
have only one brain cell that's operating 8:30 to 3:30? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm saying, you're saying what we've been saying on this podcast for at least 3 years, fam.
And material's getting old, guys.
It is. Yeah. It is. We have listeners saying, Rodrigo, get off that horse. And I'm like, nah, it's still the best Petri dish in education, son. Out of school time is the place to be. It's where we can do that stuff. Yeah. Shit. But is there anything, I want to be respectful of your time. We had you on for a while now, man. Is there any, like, thing that you want to impart on educators out here? Anybody listening? Any asks? Any final words, thoughts? Just speak on it, fam.
Yeah, man. I said it earlier, but it just is hitting me so hard. You know, we can never have equity without empathy. And empathy is really cultivated when we have proximity, you know? And so it's a revolution in our personal lives is needed. We need to have proximity to our own stories, you know, to understand the stories of our family. The story of my grandfather changed my life forever. You know what I'm saying? The more that I dig and understand about, you know, the sacrifices of my father coming here as a stowaway in a ship, not eating 4 days, you know what I'm saying? Like, the more I delve into these stories, man, I realize, you know, the responsibility and the amazing opportunity that I have, you know, to being where I'm at today. So doing that personal work is huge, but then also, you know, from that vantage point, really trying to become multiculturally competent. I think the epitome of this work is that we would experience what Dr. King and others discussed when they talked about this idea of the beloved community, you know, being in a space where we can be our authentic selves, that we can meet each other's needs, that we can understand how to speak fluently in the languages and cultural nuances of one another, you know, and to do it not in a way to check some box, to do it not in some way to fit some criteria, but to do it in a way that is reciprocally transformative. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, do the personal work. We can talk until we're blue in the face, but our actions speak so much louder. And when our words speak, and they're backed up with our walk, it's like each word is a dove that finds a resting place in the hearts and minds of these youth. And so continue to be a student of your student and continue to have fun with it, man, and experiment, because You know, being an educator, you're a DJ. You know what I'm saying? You got the DJ, the art, and
you need
the
to find the break. You need to find the break.
Find the break.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And help your young people who might be having a breakdown. And like DJ Kool Herc said, they were at a breaking point. That's why we called them break boys. But what we did here is we helped them to have a breakthrough.
My man. So, I think that's a good place to end. Fam, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
I hope you had a good time.
I did. It was fun. You're
amazing you're an amazing person with a great energy. Thank you. Thank you.
What? I thought you were gonna lean in and give him a kiss. That was cool. I thought he was gonna try to make out with the screen and shit.
Yeah,
they're
man,
like, hey,
know,
it's not cool. You, it's Here's me. Oh wait. He's,
you know,
take it easy, Rodrigo. Don't get jealous.
I know. Step off, man. Step off, man. That's my boyfriend, son.
I got the short, spiky one. It would be like, no, girl.
Hey, for real, for real. Hey, for real, for real. How many of those black t-shirts do you own, motherfucker?
Oh, here we go. Here we go. Here we go.
Every time I see you up in that motherfucker.
I'm the same way, though. I tell him, man, I wear like two shirts. I wear a white shirt and a black shirt. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, I follow Einstein's model, son. I'm not trying to think about that shit so much.
That's the artist poet, you know. It's like black shirt. Don't worry about it. Let's just go in. You know what I'm
there you go.
I don't know when it'll happen, but I hope to see you sometime in person soon, my man.
Yeah, likewise. All right, I'm going to be at Boost this year. We're doing a pre-conference certification with our curriculum, Fulfill the Dream.
Nice. Okay.
So we should.
Yeah, no, for sure. We'll see you at Boost. If not, we'll see. We'll try to link up sooner then, man.
Okay, that sounds good. I'm bringing the fam too, so we gotta get these kids.
Ooh, okay, perfect. I love it.
Yes,
I love it.
Yes, let's do it.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, bro.
Thank you. Yeah, much love, and keep up the great work, man. I love it.
We'll talk. We'll talk soon, man. I appreciate you more than you know. All right, brother.
All right, likewise.
Peace.
All right, peace,
brother. Amazing episode, Rodrigo, man. I would like to thank y'all for listening. I hope you enjoyed your time with us.
Roberto Rivera, an amazing dude. I hope y'all enjoyed that. Dude was fresh.
Episode 33 of the Educated Guest Podcast.
That's a wrap, Ski. Thank you, Ed, for taking care of the sound and enduring the
Ed
many
Nunez
takes.
On the boards.
Yeah, and for enduring Caesar Does It and him fucking up so much. Appreciate that.
60 takes by Rodrigo, Mr. _AYY. And we out, y'all.
Peace, y'all.